You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Shaheen Murali. He's a curator and writer. Shaheen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Brainerd. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So let's begin with, I know a number of your projects, and I'd like to get to some of those, but maybe we can start with something broader, which is the art world has changed rapidly in the last decade alone. And I know you have a particular perspective on its relationship to the art market throughout this rapid change, which continues. How do you see what's happening? What is your perspective on this rapid change that's happening now?
Well, alas, the art world, which is a term coined by the infamous Arthur Danto, which takes on board artists, art workers, collectors, collections, galleries, museums, curators, critiques, and also keepers of art, has or seems to have become a very difficult place. It's overtly inflated in many directions. And it remains, the market remains unfettered because in many ways, we really need it to slowly all be slowed down, to have some punctuation marks within it as it slowly mutates and changes the art world. It's a very difficult scenario because we're drifting into the errors and excesses of the market, which are very much ingrained in the economic condition. And here we're not able to read it, because we haven't had real experiences of this market, its rhythms and its melodies and how it functions, beyond the fact that it is an economic model rather than a cultural model. And there, I think, we face the challenges, vast challenges, to fight for any sense of leadership, ownership, which is necessary so that the market alone cannot express itself, but we, as a cultural body, based on notions of abilities and individual voices to be heard. So although the market is very, very important in many ways, it's substantial in the sense that it has allowed artists and curators and institutions to find a stronghold. And it has in many ways also increased the traffic of art viewers, art connoisseurs. It's made sort of a kind of a pilgrimage to some of its cultural sites. It's increased, in a sense, the sense of sanctity of culture. But it also, at the same time, made it into a spectacle. It has, in a sense, occupied the center with its economic might. And, in a sense, has taken over through this occupation of the grand spaces, which we thought were public spaces, including parks, monuments, historical buildings. Even natural scenic sites have become part of the market's growing arm. And we have to think about its relationship to status. We have to think about its relationship to land, and land as a resource, especially central sites, where they're now no longer public, but have become private. So we have to be, in a sense, guarding against its muscular, mechanical, and economic arm, become inseparable from art, which has been always about content, regardless of economic booms and busts. And in many ways, there is also a fiction in the way that the market operates, which we have to be careful about, because that fiction is all about success. And art was never only about success. It was about endeavors. It was about trying to get through to realize our lives, our experiences, our sense of knowledge, and how all of that can become wisdom. So these are some of the sort of areas which concern me a great deal, because we don't always want to be involved in these great garage sales, which art fairs tend to become. We have to remember the first art fair was only just under 50 years ago in Cologne, which is now the Cologne Art Fair, or the Art Cologne. And in that 50 years, it's really mutated and changed the way that artists see themselves, artists see their works and how they see the notion of success within an economic reality rather than in an art historical frame. So I'm always guided by the way that the artists and artworks specifically are slotted into tables about profits and promotion that leads from these profits into promotions, into collections, into history. It's a veiling activity when very much is based on value rather than cultural bequest. And in many ways, stop me if you think I'm going too far into this, but it reminds it reminds one of the quote by Samuel Beckett on James Joyce when he says, it's no longer about something, it is that something itself. So that mutation worries me a great deal in terms of how the current state of the art world has fluctuated very much towards an ends to a means rather than an ends of an expression.
I agree with you. To me, you know, there's a question, though, that seems to be difficult to answer. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I was, well, then maybe it's not a matter of right and wrong, but I was talking to a curator in Berlin recently, interviewing him, and he was saying that he had found out, was talking about the relationship of art to money and, you know, and when artists have to apologize if they're making too much money or the whole relationship to it. And he said that the Venice Biennial had a sales office up until, I think it was the late 70s, something like that, which I'd never heard of before. But there was a place where you could buy the work there. At some point, nonprofits, you know, and biennials, and perhaps this will feed into some of the work you've done directing biennials, but there is a relationship to the market there that's not defined, that's a little bit uneasy. Our artists, for the most part, for one, aren't sharing in a lot of this incredible market success. Most artists that I know have second jobs, or their success is certainly not like what we read about in the paper. So what I'm getting at is saying, is there this fundamental question that's still unresolved in the art world, which is, when should there be a sales office, and what should the relationships of nonprofits and museums be to sales of art? Isn't there something just undefined that's difficult there, even though we know what we're reaching for and the importance of beauty and its lack of monetary equivalent? You know, that's not what we're after. Isn't it a question of the unease of the relationship between those two? Otherwise, it's a capitalist monster that's just eating everything, you know?
Well, in many ways, that capitalist monster, and monster is maybe the right term, it's a term that Derrida would use to describe this whole growth in the field, where some of the sort of excuses have been made about what you said, apologies, is a kind of the shame involved in the amount of money which is floating around. The amount of yachts which are outside of the Venice Biennale has been a symbol for many people who visited the Giardini in Venice and have seen these great collectors with their yachts holding private parties and functions without regard to how much consumption is, and possibly with it exploitation, is seen as a fresh initiative. We have to be sort of careful in the sense that maybe all of these kind of larger than life sort of initiatives like a biennale, which are $1 million per event, each pavilion has been vastly supported, not only by what's seen as national, so in that sense we believe that countries have been supporting them, but they're also supported by collectors who collect the work. Most artists who have to make these very large pieces of work to fill these pavilions do not have that sort of money to make those works, and the collectors come in. A number of pavilions at the moment in Venice have been funded by collectors, and it will be the collectors' work at the end of the day. So there is there has always been a kind of corporation going on, but a hidden corporation in terms of how the commercial arm has been part of the emerging paradigms of artists conquering larger spaces, being part of spectacles like biennales, which are increasing not only in size, but in numbers around the world in different cities. And the relationship between economic value and the values we have, let's say beauty or wisdom or ideas, which have driven the relationship between what we feel should be within our reach to understand what art is and what it has become, how it's got there, it's not transparent, has never been transparent. But what it does also in that intransparency is it redefines art as an experience, which was based on having a critical frame through which we viewed it, maybe even a naive frame. What it has become, to some extent, in that intransparency, is an uncriticality, a lack of transparency, where, in a sense, the triumph of style over substance has been called by many people in how artists' images have become. That social relationship, which we always felt was necessary for art to be important, has sort of entered as another commodity, rather than something which was self-enclosed, had its own meaning, it intimated to speak about itself, and maybe a private language of an artist or their understanding of the world. It invited us to transform ourselves, change ourselves, our lives, our minds and attitudes about what the world is and how the artist is presenting it. So in many ways, it's that intransparency which has disallowed us to feel completely at ease with what the object is. How did it get there? More so than ever before, it is a kind of, we are in a sense playing with a room full of mirrors, but they're not sort of squeaky clean mirrors, the abnormal play of mirrors, because it's become so commodified, complemented by a sense that it's an accessory. It's part of a couture culture rather than a sort of very strong, level-headed sentiment produced within the studio that then comes out in the public space. I think we need to interrogate how the form has become such a mirror, this abnormal play of mirrors, since it does not reflect back the expected image we have of art anymore. You know, the idea that the artist, the lone person working away with materials and somehow turning it into something historical, something important, something which we cannot find somewhere else, but only in this. That sort of magic, that moment, to a certain extent, has been burnished by the relationship between the market, the economic turn, twists, and intransparency. But we should also remember what has been said by Karl Marx, let's say, in Das Kapital. For he says, for commodities do not walk by themselves. They do not go to the market on their own in order to meet other commodities. So artists have also been confined in this relationship. It's not something which has happened out of the blue. We have a large group of people who have been, to a large extent, left on the side, left to their own devices, who've had to study ways to make something out of their own experiences, which then can be complementary to the large expectations of the public and in public spaces. And for a very long time, many artists, and when we talk about the market, we are only talking about 5% of the artistic community. We're not talking about 95%.
Right, that's what's so odd. We're not talking about the mass of the art world, but we're talking where the...
No, we're not talking about mass. But what that 5% does is it's twisted the way that artists see themselves in terms of the success being embedded, being part of a gallery system, being part of a collection, being part of a touring program, being curated. And having, in a sense, visibility. Visibility is very difficult in a world overrun by images. So for artists to fight within that world, they have to find a complementary way that allows them to get to that platform, to be seen, and then from that to be, in a sense, people working out what they've seen and how important it is in terms of not only their own understanding and own reading, but a wider reading in an art historical frame. Maybe what right. happens in this sort of understanding is that there is a kind of stubbornness also within the 95% or the 90%, which defies the kind of futility of the way that the market operates. Because it doesn't operate consistently. It operates like all economic models in busts and booms. You know, we've seen that with mortgages. We've seen that with property. We've seen that with land. We've even seen that with products. They're there in your face really, really substantially. And then they disappear within the framework of 5 or 10 years. So there is an alternative, which is at the moment maybe silent. It's a portal of silence that is increasingly inventive within this scenario that it finds itself, where there's this model of success, which is the market, where, you know, there are catalogs, there are great amount of things written in different communication way portals, like online to catalog essays to even newspapers, which are less and less
right.
now, reporting on actually what the art world is doing. But they found themselves, in a sense, the alternative has found itself in a self-enclosure. Maybe it's meditative. Maybe it is within that that another relentless agenda for change and reform will come out of. Maybe a discourse on its own right and a flight from interpretation from within the market as a commodity to becoming at odds with the world of the market and collectors and even galleries. Maybe even a counter-paradigm might come through. Because the market is seen and is viewed very much as a kind of authoritarian paradigm that doesn't allow any alternatives to prevail. And I think that, to an extent, has created a secondary art world, which is very much to do with trying to think through how historically the heritage of art was always ridden by class, by race, by gender. It was patronizing, it was patriarchal in its methodologies. And it, as you suggested, it always had a lingering relationship to the market and was always an infected enterprise in a sense. So for the new culture producers, this possibly is actually the truth rather than something which was always hidden, as you said, with the example about the sales office. It was there, but it was just not out there for us to say, oh, that's how it works out.
Right, right. It's very interesting. So this relationship of the 90%, or how it, as I understand what you're saying, as the 90% being almost kind of, you know, poisoned by the propaganda of this 5%, it would seem very difficult to change paradigms within that, because artists all have this conflicted nature, which is, you know, there's a desire to be the 5%, right, or to be a part of that. We wouldn't turn down a large sale of a painting or a great commission. At the same time, the work is not about the money, and we would seem to be content with that, you know, in a stable lifestyle. So there's this it seems the impulse to revolt is checked by the also attraction of success in capitalist terms.
Yes, exactly. It's the way that the methods of evaluation which are used now are so steeped and purely and increasingly so in monetary terms that economic structure has kind of forced a deviation of the artist's attention to a large extent. You know, it's kind of created an economic universalism. And In a sad way, it has affected art's potential to be an experiential engagement with an aptitude to encounter change and difference. And it's also reduced the way we handle culture, because it's become puerile economic denomination. That for many art, for artists, its key producers, has lost some of its mysterious powers to actually be able to move the subject and move the audience with it. Whether the subject is a personal one or something shared with the community. Similarly, I think historians and academics and even some critiques who have always believed that art had that innate possibility to create a unique legacy for human civilization have seen the recent way that the denomination, economic denomination, is actually failing for us as viewers for art to maintain its power and to maintain its ability to change and create structures which are different to the one which we are aligned to. So I think there's something to be said about the fact that we are at a very terse situation in the last sort of 20, 30 years, where when art gets in the news, it's usually by the fact that it has won so many millions through a collector somewhere in a phone call in an auction house, either in New York, in London or in Hong Kong. 83% of the artwork is through art fairs and auction houses. In a sense, that failure is because we are taking everything from the art as if it has to be of value only in terms of monetary, within the monetary economic system. And that system can only be imposed by the very rich who have the ability to collect, who have the ability to see value in it. So value itself is construed on art by a small amount, very tightly knitted group of people, on a very large and increasingly larger community of artists, because artists themselves are increasing in numbers throughout the world, because art colleges are actually taking on more students. And students are graduating not only undergraduates, but they're becoming postgraduates and doing PhDs. So the community of artists is actually increasing not only in numbers, but also in the ability of them to be able to look at knowledge, which is within the libraries and in the system. Mm-hmm. So here we have a kind of a very strange scenario of how do we look at the substantial changes? How do we involve ourselves with artists within the global domain? How do we concentrate on understanding the phenomenon of the creative surge which is happening within art and design? Art and design is really, really increasing and exploratory in many ways. We also have a larger community which is contemplating many, many wider problems of representation through exhibitions around different subjects and subjectivities, not only in Europe, but in the rest of the world. I mean, the changes which have happened in how we perceive art in Africa as a continent, or Asia as a continent, or Latin America.
Let's talk about that in terms of something you've organized, because I'd like to talk about one project, now that we're talking about, approach and context, let's talk about what some of the challenges are for perhaps a biennial that you recently directed. What were some of the challenges that would be manifesting some of the things that we're discussing now in terms of representation of artists in this forum to a global audience? That's a big responsibility, I would think.
Yeah. You see, in many ways, when one comes from this position of observing and drawing from the experience of curating in different institutions, a number of different institutions, and institutions are also in different scales in how and what they can make as exhibitions, how they can enhance a comprehension of what is curating or what is historical or what is even heritage. It affects the way that the role of the contemporary curator should be, in a sense, concerned with. The challenges which occur, let's say, working in a city like Calcutta in India, which I have, to somewhere like in Vienna in Austria, which I also have, is there are vast differences in terms of everything from minutiae of how art is handled, transported, to how you create context for it. And in terms of the physical aspects, of course, countries differ greatly in terms of art handling is a very specific phenomena within the art world. How you transport, how you pack, how you unpack, how you actually put it up. Some of those skills are missing in some of the countries, of course, because they're very young in drawing on the expertise. Have concepts such as conservation of artwork or conditions of artwork that artwork can be placed in. And then at the other scale, there might be great amount of skills around those ideas. Have no idea about why something is important to come from one country to another. So what is important about bringing work from, let's say, somewhere like Japan to Australia? Why is it important to see something Japanese, contemporary Japanese ideas about art? In many ways, what one has to establish as a curator is to think through not only the representation of ideas, but to maintain and to think about how to transcend the biases and the skills which may not exist where you find yourself curating. So the contemporary state of art is not one, it's not homogeneous at all. There are different zones that transmit and transcend, through which to transmit and transcend. And my concerns are always tinged when I start with a sense of skepticism. How do you work with what you find yourself within? What is it that they don't get or I get, and I need to think about how to place it in front of somebody else so they also get it? What are the effects, and how is it going to actually operate in relationship to the more greater art world that we find ourselves within? So it's not only educational, but it's also very much to do with keeping some sort of notion that there are some residual values which we need to hold on to about why we're doing things. And that's why I started with the notion of the market, because if our residual values are always notions about monetary, a sense of monetary value, then we are already, in a sense, enforcing a system which may be not good, kind, or right to apply to another system, another place. Because places need to find their own models of how to create exhibitions, how to create a discourse around artists and how they function and what they're trying to say particularly. A good artist draws always from their own locality to be able to then use that locality to create a sense of greater value for the rest of the world. It provides a structure. It also provides an intimacy. And it has a consistency. So when you see a set of works coming from one country, you'll be able to recognize that country, that place, that time within the work. But you should be able to also find yourself wherever you are within that work. And so language...
You're talking about the references to locality within that work.
The references of locality are important. I think they are important because in a sense we are living in a time which we have called globalization, but we are also living in a time which we are beginning to call neoliberal, in the sense that globalization is turning into a place where things have become taken up by more and more corporate and capital standardization. Yeah, and the art world is part of that. It's part of that standardization. So, in many ways, what we should think about in exhibition making or curatorship and also collections is how does it affect dramatically the way we are both attracted to the world, a sense of our place in the world, and how do we, in a sense, allow it to flourish as an energy in the sense of making exhibitions, allowing collections to happen. So what I mean by that is the energy is for art to continue, because the artists in certain societies are really not well supported. They don't have structures and infrastructure such as funding bodies or even an arts council or alternative systems of galleries. They're really coming out from systems which are absolutely dependent just on themselves and not a wider group of players. So we have to, in a sense, create a sense of space for them in different parts of the world. And this is why I'm attracted to the idea of works coming from one country going to another and also from that country going back to the other. So I did a series of exhibitions in Tehran, from India. They're close by to each other, and they have a shared history through the Mughal Empire. Yet contemporary artists are not placed within their burgeoning ideas of what an exhibition should be, and the burgeoning independence of artists making work there. So I did three exhibitions in Iran of contemporary artists from India, and I took a large-scale exhibition of a group exhibition from Iran and artists of Iranian diaspora to Mumbai. And it was interesting because this was the first time these exhibitions had taken place in these countries and an exchange had occurred. And it was dramatic in the sense that it talked about the energies of those spaces, the actors, the artists, who had created a realm which was important to them, but also should be, in a sense, accessible to a wider art audience in different scenarios. And what can we learn about then from them? And what happens is the potential that the stakeholders could increase. And what did happen was that there has been shows in Tehran which have increased from outside of Iran, which is under an embargo, and there have been shows from Iran in India that followed through. And it just takes a certain amount of thinking about how to do it and how to collect that energy, a group of people, to be able to do it, and then to increase the sort of ability for those countries, those societies, which seem to be on the margin. And I hope in the near future, major institutions and other exhibitions, including which would include these artists, would be able to inform and create a status in favor of those who remain outside and who have remained outside because of political reasons, because of economic reasons, or because the fact that they don't come from a central periphery, they don't come from a central of the art world, but come from the periphery of the art world. So for me, curating has been an experiment about how do we communicate from places where the imaginary, where Iran has a very strong imaginary community. It uses the imaginary because, and the poetics, because it itself is under attack from within. It is, you know, systematically policed by its own system. So it's produced an art form which still is political, still is important in terms of the way that it works with aesthetics. But it is a new form because of the fact that it has, in many ways, both internal and external pressures onto the artists to not be able to speak absolutely freely the way that they could if they lived outside of it as in a diaspora. So I was interested in those sort of questions. How do we communicate ideas? How do we learn from these observations? How is the local knowledge and the local notations of that knowledge, of those lives, to be allowed to have some space in other spaces, like, you know, between India and Iran in this case? I've also done that similarly with Palestine, which itself is also under a very strong but very different restricted scenario.
Shaheen, it's been a pleasure talking to you about this and getting your and discussing these views, because I agree with you, fortunately, and they're I think what's important to think about in the future of what you're doing. Just to, in closing, is there another project that you're working on that we should be looking out for or perhaps visiting?
Well, you know, what has happened is that in many ways, having worked on a number of different projects in different parts of the world, and they extend everywhere from Indonesia to Brazil and places in between, I found myself more or less in touch with a great number of artists from different places. And some of those artists are now asking not necessarily to be placed in a public space, but a relationship which is more one-to-one, a kind of a strange a mentorship which has happened. So some of the relationships have come through artists asking actually to have a more solid relationship with the curator in terms of how does a curator challenge their perceptions of the way that the world is changing. So some of the things that I'm working on, I'm actually working individually with artists on that level. But the other aspect of my work has been to start writing essays, which allows those artists to have a voice within the written frame rather than the viewed frame. And in that sense, a lot of my work at the moment is not necessarily within the public domain, which is a sector where I challenge a lot of notions about centralization and provided platforms for multiple ideas. But now, in a sense, the contacts have become much more with themselves and not formal. So they're not about contracts, but more about contacts. And it's a sense of curatorship, which is not about managing a style of culture, but responding to culture developments, which are happening on an individual level, or people who are turned, in a sense, towards the same light as I am, or experience the world in a similar fashion to what I have. So it's about a fragility, it's about an ecology of ideas, it's about the role of the curator, not necessarily as the important central figure, but being part of arts consciousness. And how do we successfully use artistic production as a place and as a way of contesting further ideas and possibly looking at the notions again through that in different ways, the margins, the market, the periphery, the impact, and to go beyond galleries, museums, book deals, and conferences, and to think about our individual growth.
Thank you so much, Shaheen, for talking with us today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIVC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.